Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It as part of our Juneteenth coverage this week. We've been looking at underreported moments in Black history and Black history makers. Today, we're going to recall the role of an African-American who broke ground in a sport not necessarily thought to be friendly to Black athletes, car racing. Although there have been some strides. Last summer, in the midst of a nationwide reckoning about systemic racism, NASCAR made a momentous decision. It decided to ban the Confederate flag from all of the sports events. Race car driver Bill Lester was very pleased that time had finally come. In 1999, Bill made history when he became the first African-American person to race in NASCAR's Busch Series, the first African-American driver to win any Grand Am division, and is one of only a handful of Black men to ever compete at the professional level in race car driving. I spoke to Bill back in February about his career, his experiences as a Black NASCAR driver, and about his book, Winning in Reverse, Defying the Odds and Achieving Dreams, The Bill Lester Story. I began the conversation by asking Bill when he first developed a fascination with race car driving.
Well, it was at a very early age. My parents told me I didn't go anywhere without a Matchbox or a Hot Wheels car in my hand. So I knew I liked cars. And, you know, as soon as I got on a bike, a little Stingray bicycle, I rode it as fast as I could. So I just loved going fast. And, you know, my father, he saw that I had this passion for, you know, cars and speed. And so he took me to a race just shy of my being 8 years old in Northern California at a track called Laguna Seca in Monterey. And I was just mesmerized and blown away by it. And I knew at a very early age that race car driving was something I really wanted to do.
But it wasn't what you initially pursued. For people who don't know your story, you have a dual degree in electrical engineering and computer science. You were fast-tracked management at Hewlett-Packard, working on developing computer diagnostics. You know, some people would consider that you were on your road to success in this field. So what made you decide to, pardon the pun, but take a turn?
Well, because I define success as happiness. I was not happy doing what I was doing, even though I was successful by everybody else's definition but my own. You know, they thought, hey, Bill, you know, you're making a six-figure income. You've got responsibilities in terms of, you know, managing a couple dozen engineers and, you know, got stability. You have everything that supposedly success, quote unquote, is. But for me, success was happiness, and I wasn't happy, so I didn't consider myself successful. So it wasn't as if I all of a sudden woke up one day and decided to throw away, you know, this career in the high tech industry to go racing. No, nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is I wanted to be a race car driver, but I just didn't have the opportunities that most race car drivers get when they're a very young age. You know, usually in their single digit years, most aspiring race car drivers come from affluent families that can afford to put them behind the wheel of either a go-kart or a quarter midget, or just a small-scale race car that a kid can drive. And they soon begin to climb the ladder of success to allow them to, at some point, become a professional. Well, that was not the situation for me. My parents thought I was crazy, for the most part, to want to pursue something in racing. But they said, hey, you know, that's your dream. That's your passion. You know, good luck. We hope you make it. But one of the things that you might want to use is, you know, a career to center you and back, you know, basically provide a backstop for you in case you don't make it. And that's what the high tech industry was for me. That's what going to the University of California, Berkeley, and getting an electrical engineering and computer science degree was. It was a tool. It was a means to an end, because effectively with that engineering degree, I started working as a, you know, software development professional, but almost immediately bought myself a race car. So here I am in my early 20s, just starting out in my career, you know, as an amateur, not a professional, but as an amateur, and then getting to the point that at 37 years of age, I had gotten married at that point, and my wife, Cheryl, she sat me down one day and she said, "Hun, you're not getting any younger, and you're definitely not getting any easier to live with because you're miserable. Go pursue your passion. You know, you've worked hard. We've saved some money. I'm also doing very well in my career. You know, my wife, she's a smart person in the household. She's got the MBA from Stanford, right? So I outkicked my coverage, I like to say. But she encouraged me to leave the nest and to pursue this dream. And so we gave ourselves a 3-year window by which to make this dream a reality, or realize that I gave it my best and it wasn't meant to be, and I would have to go back to the realization of going back into the high-tech sector. Fortunately, that didn't happen, and I was able to move on into racing.
Yeah, you're right about your wife. You're right. Cheryl has the patience of a saint. I mean, in terms of your own patience, especially when you're somebody who's used to achieving, when you first start out in something, you don't start at the top. What kind of conversations did you have to have with yourself about that?
Exactly. You know, I had to have an innate, inherent ability in my, you know, faith in my abilities. And I had that. You know, as soon as I got a driver's license, I was doing all kinds of silly things that I don't condone on the street. I mean, I was street racing. I was doing the Fast and the Furious before it was a movie. And so, you know, people that I raced and what have you would say, you know, look, you got a lot of skill, a lot of talent. Take it off the streets. You know, you don't want to race illegally. Anything can happen. Go out there into a controlled environment and see if you really have what it takes. And I was like, sounds great. How do I do it? Well, you've got to get a race car. And so that's when I knew, you know, I had to get an occupation that would allow me to, you know, afford to go racing. And that's why I, you know, I took the road that I chose. But you're right. I mean, there were no guarantees. I had already, you know, since I had made it in high tech, had a stable career, stable income, you know, had the trappings of quote unquote success. But again, you know, I was living for the weekend. I couldn't wait to get out there and race on Saturdays and Sundays. And so that's why, you know, fortunately, I was able to turn all of my time and attention by going on a leave of absence initially with Hewlett Packard. And then 6 months into my leave, just leaving because I gained enough traction with people that I had met along the way during, you know, my amateur career and some of the early professional races that I had participated in to, you know, basically embark upon just entrenching myself full time in the pursuit of racing full time. And so, you know, the networking was key. Getting out of my comfort zone was key in terms of, you know, doing things that I didn't know whether or not it was going to pay off, but I believed in myself. I had a passion and a desire to make this dream, you know, a reality. And so all of those things that I had, you know, basically learned in terms of how to present myself, how to position myself, how to try to, you know, get to where I needed to go. I, you know, really heavily relied upon them and leaned on them. And I was able to get opportunities that finally opened the doors to my becoming a professional.
My guest is Bill Lester. The name of his book is Winning in Reverse, Defying the Odds and Achieving Dreams. I think most people know about you that there's just a handful of Black drivers who have been a part of this sport. When you think about it and you sort of pull out, what's the barrier to entry for people of color?
I can basically equate that or, you know, narrow it down to two things. One's exposure and the second is opportunity. Mm-hmm. What I mean by exposure is that you have to be exposed to it at a young age. Fortunately, my father did that for me. He took me to this race, like I spoke about in California, in Monterey. And so I was exposed to racing. By and large, in the Black community, we're not exposed to racing. We're exposed to stick and ball sports, predominantly, or the music industry, you know, the music and entertainment industry. That's kind of what most, you know, the African-American community considers as, you know, successful, popular, the type of, you know, pursuit that you may want to, you know, go for. For me, it was all about cars. And so I was exposed to it early. So once somebody is exposed to it at a young age, then you have to have the opportunity to participate. And that is extremely difficult because racing is so expensive. People don't have appreciation for how much it costs to go racing at the professional level in particular. If we're talking about the NASCAR Cup Series, which is the top step of the ladder in NASCAR, that's racing on Sundays. That's, you know, the Jeff Gordons and the Dale Earnhardts and the Jimmy Johnsons, those guys. That is an $18 to $22 million proposition each year in sponsorship to be able to compete at that level. That is not typically, you know, mom and dad's money. That is corporate money. And the access to capital is not enjoyed by the Black community like it is to the mainstream. Most of the people that are making those decisions in those C-suites are typically white and typically white male. And they tend to typically support those that are like them mm-hmm. and that they can identify with, and that it's the typical tried and true scenario. Most executives I've come to realize are fairly risk averse. They're not willing to put their career or their reputation, you know, on the line by doing something that is out of the box. They go with the same old, you know, we've done this before, we'll do it again. They typically are risk averse because of the potential consequences they feel that might happen if something goes wrong. They don't look at it as the opportunity to do something new, to do something that hasn't been done before, to actually open the doors for more people, you know, in terms of inclusion and diversity, to take part in the racing and in the sport and become, you know, those that take their brand and run with it. They look at typically working through the usual, you know, very short and narrow lens of doing the same thing over and over again. So you have to have the opportunity. It's exposure at a young age, and it's opportunity to become involved in it. Even at a very young age, when I was talking about go-karts and quarter midgets, if we're talking about racing for a national championship at a young age, that's a six-figure proposition. Now, how many kids in the Black community have parents that can afford to put them in a go-kart or a quarter midget and put six figures behind them so that they can race for a championship at 8, 9 years old? That typically doesn't happen. Most of these kids that are out there racing, they come from opportunity and wealth and, you know, families that can afford to drop that kind of money behind them. You know, a lot of these kids are homeschooled because they compete on the road, and they're taught while they're on the road competing. That doesn't really happen in the Black community.
My guest is Bill Lester. The name of the book is Winning in Reverse, Defying the Odds and Achieving Dreams. So, Bill, I do need to ask you about your thoughts about this past summer, NASCAR banning the flying of the Confederate flag at racetracks. This happened, but on the flip side, we've seen the racism that Bubba Wallace has had to endure. I'm sure you write about it in your book, things that you've had to endure. How has NASCAR changed during your lifetime that you think has been positive? And what is one thing you think still needs to change?
So, you know, I was really pleased when NASCAR made the monumental statement of banning the Confederate flag. That was something I didn't think that I would see or experience them doing in my lifetime. You know, when I was racing in the mid-2000s in NASCAR, I made it very clear to everybody who was in earshot that I was not comfortable being at these venues with the Confederate flag flying in the breeze. But I understood that that was the culture of NASCAR. You know, NASCAR was born and bred out of the Deep South, out of moonshining and that sort of thing. And so I understood the culture. But it absolutely made me uncomfortable because here I am growing up in Northern California in the Bay Area. And, you know, there's just no real exposure that I had to that environment, you know. And when I watched as a very young boy on ABC's Wide World of Sports, you know, the big races in NASCAR, like the Daytona 500 or the Southern 500 at Darlington or the Talladega 500 in, you know, Talladega, Alabama, I watched these cars running around the track with the flag blowing in the breeze. And when I heard, you know, the drivers being interviewed and the Southern drawls and the accents that they spoke with, I just couldn't get with that. It was just an environment, and it was a situation that was very just disconcerting to me. It wasn't welcoming. It wasn't inviting. It was a put off. So for me to actually wind up in NASCAR, I would have never thought in a million years that would happen. But getting back to when I was talking about, you know, speaking to the media about my feelings about NASCAR when I was competing, you know, I said, yeah, I mean, I don't really feel comfortable in the environment, but as long as nobody's waving a Confederate flag in my face, I understand the culture of the sport. And I just look at it as, you know, okay, well, that's what they grew up with. That's their comfort zone. I have to get out of my comfort zone to be able to deal with the environment that I was placed under. And at the end of the day, it really didn't matter because I was there to do a job. I wanted to beat these guys. You know, I wanted to race. Mm-hmm. I wanted to race with what was the best, considered the best drivers in our country. That was NASCAR competition. So, you know, while I had to endure looking at the flag, I was trying to make it clear that this is one of the reasons why at the time that I was racing, there isn't more diversity in the sport, because it's an environment that is not welcoming to those of color. So fast forward, you know, the clock to 2020, and, you know, the Confederate flag is banned because of the situations that occurred in our country with Black Lives Matter and, you know, the very clear examples of police brutality and things that took place that made everybody stand up and look at some of the atrocities that were taking place in this country. So it was a rare time in our history where everybody had their eyes and their ears open and were concerned about how people were being treated and how there was a disparity in terms of how people were being treated. So NASCAR, it was a perfect storm. It was a perfect opportunity with Bubba Wallace being on the scene to be able to talk to NASCAR and say, look, this flag has to go. The flag that we should be saluting and that we should be embracing is the American flag, not the Confederate flag. It's a part of history, and that's where it belongs, in a museum. And so NASCAR, to their credit, they took note, they listened, and they banned it. So, you know, in answer to your second question is, you know, what does NASCAR need to continue to do? They need to make it very clear that they stand behind what they say, and they really need to make an effort to go into, you know, Black communities and you know, Hispanic communities, you know, where people of color are, and make everybody feel warm and welcomed mm-hmm. to taking advantage of the sport that NASCAR is. You know, until, again, you know, we feel like we are valued and that we are, you know, that they want us to be there, that NASCAR wants us to be there, it's going to continue to be, you know, just dominated by an aged out white audience. You know, because really what's gone on in the past is that the millennials, the youngsters, in the white community haven't really not gravitated to NASCAR like their parents did. And, you know, they're losing market share. And so for NASCAR to consider itself to be America's sport, it needs to reflect the diversity of America.
That was my conversation with groundbreaking NASCAR driver Bill Lester about his book, Winning in Reverse, Defying the Odds and Achieving Dreams, The Bill Lester Story.